SciByte is produced by JupiterBroadcasting.com. Independent entertainment that's on demand. Check us out. Hi everyone, you're listening to SciByte, Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly science podcast. We recorded this one live on May 1st, 2012. This is episode 44. My name is Chris, and joining us, like every single week, is our host, Heather. Hey there, Heather.
Hey there, Chris.
Hey, happy science to you, Heather.
Happy science.
What do we have coming up in today's episode of SciByte?
Today we're going to take a look at mining asteroids, recovery from strokes, lefties, talking to yourself, solar cells, a review of some recent major new media stories, viewer feedback, spacecraft updates, and as always, take a peek back into history and up in the sky this week.
Well, so I don't usually do this, but this week I got a hold of you before the show. I guess it must have been Saturday, Sunday, probably. And I was asked, Mars, did you see this story? And you're like, oh, Chris, it's already in the news, doc. So I have been looking forward to talking about this for days. So should we jump into the news?
Let's go.
All right, what is the first story in the news?
Docket. Today is mining asteroids.
Okay. All right, so people have been talking a lot about this, and honestly, some very rich people sound like they're very serious about getting into this. Is this crap?
Not total. I mean, the idea has been around for over 100 years. You know, you see little rocks out there, you're like, hey, we should go out there, dig up some cool stuff, and bring it back.
Right, yeah. Well, and especially as we run out of resources here at home. And
right, now
also
it's becoming more.
Right. Well, and, you know, with the manufacturing, just with even, and the thing is, this has kind of become a bigger deal. Just, you know, in the last few years with the proliferation of smartphones and iPads, I was reading an article in the New York Times that talked about, like, Apple, one of the reasons they build the iPad and the iPhone in China, besides labor, is because all of the precious materials and resources that they need are also in China. So there's an economy there for all those. And also the similar situation in Africa, where there's a lot of those types of materials that are in an area that has a lot of issues. And so it's hard to get to them and mine them. So you got to figure people are going to look up to those asteroids and start rubbing their fingers together and making plans.
Yeah, I mean, they're very different compositions of asteroids. There are, you know, various types. But there are some that will have, you know, those rare materials, possibly those rare minerals. The ones that are found in closer to Mars and Earth, kind of like stone and iron type. And there's, you know, various types of those. The question is, how come we can actually talk about it now?
Right.
It's because we've been discovering and characterizing enough of these small near Earth asteroids. You know, occasionally here I'm like, oh, one just passed between the Earth and the Moon. Oh my gosh, we're 6 hours away from completely dinosauring out of the universe. And so there's these smaller ones.
Did you just make up a term for extinction?
Yes.
Nice.
I did.
I like that one. Dinosauring it out.
Yep.
Okay.
So
hold on, Heather. You know what? You earned yourself a SciByte. No, no, it's good. You got yourself a ding. There you go.
Oh, okay. I was like, oh no.
But so we've obviously, and didn't we also cover, I think we might have covered on the show, about a probe that was smashed into an asteroid to get details about what was in it. I mean, we've been getting very curious.
Yeah, we've had those. We've had fly by them. Recently, in the last month, there was a video put out that was essentially a composition of a whole bunch of these images as we flew by one of these asteroids. So we're getting more different abilities to get to them and just, you know, investigate them. We're having more equipment, solar electric propulsion, letting us get to these much better. So it's estimated that, you know, some people think there'll be a human presence on the moon or around the moon by the 2020s.
What can they possibly base that off of?
You know, I'm not sure.
I shouldn't make the assumption they meant American.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
maybe. Yeah.
Certainly possible.
Yeah.
And maybe not governmental.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
but
sure.
That could also mean just remote probes that we keep up there that we're interacting with, I suppose.
That seems quite feasible to me.
Yeah. But the reason why this has come up now, why it made it the big news, is because a company, Planetary Resources, Inc., they've actually come out and publicly announced that they have plans to mine asteroids.
Now, this is interesting because they have some pretty big backers who have some deep pockets. And they've shown some concept videos of different ways they could mine that seem, to me, as a extreme layman, very potentially plausible. They have a smallish craft that they would launch, and then it would collect the resources, and it would be much larger on return, but, you know, the expensive part is launching, and then it would be sort of a small, lighter self.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems practical.
Yeah. I mean, they've been around for 3 years or so, and they only had to go public because now they want to put out job ads. They're like, all right, we really need these people, but we kind of have to announce why we need these people to get the right people.
Very true.
It helps. But, I mean, like you're saying, there's, you know, Google execs, there's all sorts of different people, even James Cameron. Tried to do some things, astronaut Tom Jones, MIT scientists. There's all these people. Now, they're definitely quite a few years away from actually doing this kind of a thing, but they're talking about going out, possibly seizing an asteroid, bringing it closer to the Earth, mining it, or going out, you know, get some materials on it and then come back. There's different things that are going to happen, but they will be able to use telescopes, like Hubble or other orbiting telescopes or ground-based telescopes to kind of look at all of these, you know, the data that's already there or data that might come soon, or could they, you know, rent a small piece of time off one so they can look at these near-Earth asteroids that they might be able to go out to. Then kind of start building up a library of these going, I think these are the more interesting ones. We should probably try. These are smaller and interesting. We should probably try them first.
Sure, yeah. That way they kind of don't waste money on something that returns. Because the worst case scenario, if they have some big expensive thing and they send it up there and it comes back with dust.
Yeah, it comes back with pails of dirt.
That's not going to go over too well. You're not going to get too many more investors. Now, do you know any kind of the business details? Like, are they legitimately assembling prototypes, or is this like a bunch of really great business plans and maybe like a office in some small room somewhere? I mean, do you know at what stage they're at?
I think that's why they had to put out the call for these engineers. They were looking for engineers, you know, to actually get this designed and fleeted, you know, scale up from Bruce Willis. I got to have that dig in
there. You went there.
Of course I had to. But, you know, so I think that they're getting to the point where they really need the nitty gritty numbers and drawings and 3D graphics to kind of get this further. It looks like they have some of that already. But in order to like take the next step, you know, bring it from really good concept and designs and business ideas to more realistic, how do you put this together? It could actually fly and go out there and come back, says scientist A, B, and engineers C and D. I think that's where they're moving right now.
Well, it's pretty interesting. And I guess at some point, none of this has been really well defined because there's no industry doing this yet. So it's going to be to somebody's advantage to be the first person to get up there, because whatever laws are created, I'm sure they will have heavy influence on if they're sort of the front runner.
Yeah,
I mean, how does that work? You can't own an asteroid.
No. Well, that's where the interesting twist comes in.
Now you're taking it from the universe. You're not even, I mean, Earth, at least at some level, is quote unquote ours. So you can quote unquote assign ownership over a piece of the Earth, but an asteroid.
Well, 1967 Outer Space Treaty, it like is quoted and it has a whole bunch of articles, you know, essentially saying nobody can go and claim the moon as your own. You know, no nation can go and claim sovereignty over any one thing outside of Earth.
Okay.
No other celestial body. But the question is, they specifically stated nations. So does that apply to individuals or companies? So can a company go out and say, land on an asteroid and sort of stake its claim?
Well, and won't they, in a sense, I would think, if they just found an area that was rich in materials, they would probably, I would think, have a very large area around that to avoid any kind of danger with another company's operation. So you would essentially claim something as your own just by getting there first, I would think, because you're not going to authorize somebody else to work on that same rock.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible that some of the larger asteroids, should they be able to get there, you know, some smaller company may be able to say, I want this section. You stay on your side of the asteroid. You know, draw like little kid style, draw the line down the asteroid. I mean, could you make stakes, you know, plot out a stake in an asteroid? Could you buy out the hole? Well, it's an interesting idea. I mean,
something like this, though, seems almost we have to do it. And that's always why I've always been so kind of bummed out when we talk about shutting down the space program, not actually having any firm plans, because it's like, geez, if we don't get out there, we are literally at the point now where we can see the end of the availability of the resources that we rely upon. I mean, like literally as a species, we can calculate that and we know it's coming up, and it's like, we have to get these from somewhere.
Yeah. I will try to keep this thought in a closed, not going off on a spiel concept, but the idea of going to space is sort of, it's the way to go. It's the difference between the Star Trek future and the apocalypse, everyone goes to the end future. If you decide that there is only on Earth, there's only so many finite resources, everyone else is your enemy. Everyone else is competing for you for something. Every other country is competing for you for something.
Yeah.
And everyone else is your enemy. And it's not to your advantage that anyone else gets smarter or be able to get anything more. But if space becomes available, then you want everyone to have an idea. You want, you know, some random peasant in another country to be able to possibly get education so that they can help further the science that says, hey, let's go out there, let's get this done. And now we have all these other resources to our understanding, to our knowledge, and, you know, to our, you know, that we own.
Well, let's talk about, what do you think the feasibility is? Since asteroid mining seems incredibly difficult, and it's going to be extremely rare for an opportunity, it's probably going to be a very, at least early on, something that very rarely happens. What about looking more internally, under the sea, deep sea mining, that kind of stuff? Is that practical and is that dangerous? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
They are actually moving forward with this. There are a couple, no, there's a Canadian-based company. They're looking into some of the sea off the coast of China. There's particular areas that have high grades of copper, gold, zinc, silver.
Geez, China really lucked out, didn't they?
Well, it's just geographically, it's where some hydrothermal vents are, and it's not too deep. I mean, there are, you know, about a mile under the sea level. So a little bit difficult. So then there's the idea of, how do you do that? Do you, you know, do everything down there, or do you just put it on a conveyor and chug the seafloor up the conveyor belt and do what you want to it on Earth, on the ground?
What kind of environmental impact does this have? Do we know?
That's another question.
Seems like a big one.
Yeah, these are all ideas. I mean, there are specific technological resources that we need that are kind of, they're saying, we need these to make computers and iPads and all this kind of stuff. I don't know how many more units, you know, by iPad 10.
Yeah,
are we going to be worried?
I mean, they sold 13 and a half million in the last 3 months. Yeah. So,
yeah. So by that point, so we're looking at other places. I mean, there's 2/3 of the Earth is covered in water. So we're looking to see, you know, what outside of the Earth can we get? What is close by? What's under the sea? Where are all the places that we can get all these materials? How feasible is it? What kind of impacts would it have? You know, looking at things legally, look at things environmentally based.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of different things that we're looking towards, and technology is kind of up to the point that it is reasonable that we could go out, that we could start designing something to go out, you know, dig up a scoop of something on an asteroid and bring it back, or go under the sea and successfully, possibly, you know, mine specific minerals out.
That seems like such a short term. I mean, short term in the terms of the universe.
Yeah, well,
it is not a very, I mean, you could maybe get another, 100 years of materials, but then what are we going to do? We still have the core issue.
Well, I mean, there are some ideas that, you know what, I'm going to have some great emergency rations come, but I can't get them for a year, but they will last 20 years. But I need, so I'll put that on order and I'll get that, but I need something to last me between this and next year.
Oh, yeah.
So it's reasonable to get in stages of things. You know, make these plans for these great things that we can do. Keep moving those forward. And but also do...
Exhaust what, you know, we have now.
No, just have some short-term and mid-term solutions to get to that point.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
I mean, it doesn't make sense for me to starve for a year waiting for, you know, my rations to come in, but...
You probably just should have gotten your food taken care of earlier.
Well, you know, what
what are you
gonna
do?
I don't have a time machine. I don't have the neutrinos to send back messages to myself.
The Kronton particles are lacking, and so you can't... Hindsight's 20/20 and all that, but...
Yep.
Imagine, though, if we had stayed on trajectory, if we had kept on our space path, maybe we would be a little closer to that. But like you say, you do make a very good point. We have to do something in the meantime. So what are we going to do? You gotta do something.
Yeah, as long as we're moving forward in other ideas, then just keep moving forward in those and figure out what we can do in the mid to short term to get us there.
Great links for this story in the show notes, as well as a link to the story about the seafloor mining. And also a video of the from the company that's talking about actually going up there. And there's like a little behind the scenes stuff and the showing some of their machinery and some of their design work. Oh, cool. Any other thoughts on that one?
No, it's just let's figure out how we're going to get all these things.
No kidding, because we apparently needs our iPads.
Yes.
This is actually a hilarious tie-in, but I bet iPads will be a very popular gift this Mother's Day. And everyone knows, because I mention it all the time, that if you go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and you scroll all the way down to the very bottom of the website, we have links down there for Amazon US, Amazon UK, ThinkGeek, Newegg, Best Buy, Mint.com, Audible.com, which I love, Gamefly, which is new, and also we have a Chrome extension, which you can use to automate a lot of those affiliate services. Now, the Amazon US, that's an interesting one, and Amazon UK, because like I mentioned, it is, of course, Mother's Day in like a week and 2 weeks or 2 weeks away. Like,
yeah, 2 weeks away.
2 weeks away. It's like actually it's like not. It's even less than that.
Yeah.
But if you're going to buy from Amazon this year, consider using our affiliate link at the bottom of the site before you go. Of course, now Amazon will tell you the Kindle Fire.
Well, of course.
You know, maybe. I could actually see the Kindle Fire probably would be a very good mom gift because it's simple enough. And, you know, Amazon's got a pretty good content library and it's cheaper than an iPad.
True.
So that's not a bad way to go. And we get a great cut on those Kindles if you go that route. I think Jupiter Broadcasting gets more than the average product when you do that.
Just think about that. You could get your mom for something for Mother's Day, and then you could tell her, hey, I also listen to cool science and technology shows, and they make me smarter. Aren't you proud?
And they made a little cut off of your Kindle there, Mom.
Yeah.
And then you know what else is very meta about all of that? Is if people actually do that and we actually make a little revenue, that's probably what I'll do is I'll use that once we get paid to buy Angela's Mother's Day gift. So it's very meta. It all comes together.
It all comes together.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, who does that. All right, Heather, are you ready for the SciBite News Bite? Oh, my goodness. What is the first story in the News Bite?
Today we're going to talk about recovery from strokes.
Wow.
So it's kind of a not so much of an upper topic, but there's a drug administration is looking up currently after you get a stroke, you get administered drugs to break up clots.
Right.
You know, needs to be given within about 4.5 hours after the stroke. So they're kind of looking for alternatives because it's not often that someone gets in that quickly. Oftentimes it may happen in their sleep or, you know, if it's a minor one, just kind of blow it off until later. But now they've now discovered there's a brain-derived neutrophilic factor that's it's powerful and long enough that it has nerve growth. So we're looking at the development of the nervous system, how it involves with the brain functions, memory, learning. And there's this compound that they found that mimics the behavior of this specific neural factor. So little tiny molecule, you know, lays much less than the actual thing. It can go through and it can actually speed the recovery of after a stroke. They had a mice trial, as often these do. And the mice who received the drug showed as many of this, you know, they were looking at the nerve cells as opposed to their counterparts, and they had half of the stroke affected nerves than without the drug.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it actually wasn't even administered until 3 days after the strokes. So it doesn't, it's not just that it limits the first output. It's not decreasing the stroke itself, but it actually aids recovery. And because it's so, because it was administered 3 days after and it still works, then that is definitely an upper, because you can give this to someone afterwards and it lets them be able to stimulate your brain's own stem cells to form new neurons.
Wow.
So they can, so it's not using some of this, you know, stem cell technology, wherever you stand on that. It's using your brain, your body's own stem cells. It's stimulating that to get your brain to make new neurons so that you can recover. And there was recovery of, you know, they were stronger and moving the affected limbs more quickly. So it's really promising that, you know, they have this drug that sort of, a lot of these drugs are triggering things that are already in our body.
Yeah, that's amazing that a drug can trigger that.
Yeah. So it's like there's our body's defenses in there, and they're finding the right things to go in and tweak the right switch.
Right.
You know, you have to make sure that it's not, you know, flipping a couple others at the same time. But
I mean, depending on your situation, you know, there's some people, yeah. I mean, look at chemo, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of side effects to that, but versus the alternative.
Yeah. There's, you know, I have family with the severe arthritis, and they are given a drug. Now, that drug has side effects. Of course, the other side effect is not being able to walk.
Right.
Because the arthritis kicks in so much trouble.
Yeah. My grandpa had a stroke in a nap. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he was having a nap. And he kind of, like, woke up later on and kind of realized what had happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he went to the hospital right away. When the doctor found out later, they were not happy with him.
No, that's one of the reasons why they like this, as because a lot of older people, when that happens, they just kind of, man, I'll brush it off. My great-grandmother actually had one in her 20s.
Wow.
It was sort of a thing that the family is like, all right, everyone be aware of this. If something funky goes on, don't even think that just because you're 20-something that it's not that.
Yeah, definitely right.
Go in and get it checked out.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, any other thoughts on that one?
I think anytime these drugs make steps forward, it's very intriguing and hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Now, if they could develop it, now do you know, so I suppose once the time is up, they're so theoretically, they take a drug for a while, it's the stem cells are activated, they sort of do the neurological repairs they need to do, and then the person can stop taking the drug?
I would assume, from what I can tell, that would be the way.
I hope so.
It's just like, it seemed like it was almost like physical therapy.
Yeah, okay.
Where you go, you get things back into the happy place, and then you go. Now, of course, you know, once you've had one stroke, then they have to watch you because you're more likely to have blood clots. Yeah. There might be some sort of, you know, drug combination in working in a team that you can make sure that it produces the effects. You kind of bounce back quicker and it doesn't happen to you again in the future.
I would move to California and get a medical marijuana card like that. That's what I would do. Now, I have a question for you, Heather. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
I am left-handed.
Oh, really? Well,
yes.
Why don't you tell us about our, I mean, I don't know why I happened to ask that, but do tell us.
Because I read a story about the competitive nature of lefties.
All right, tell us about this.
I call shenanigans on myself for having a story about being left-handed.
Would you consider yourself a competitive person?
Somewhat, yes.
Yeah, I could see. I would agree, but not in like a hostile way. You're very polite about your competitiveness.
Well,
that's the best kind of competitive person.
Yeah. Well, it's the competitive nature in the fact that, just take a step back, you know, they really don't know what's going on, why you're left-handed or right-handed. Maybe genetics, maybe environmental, but on the average, about 10% of the population are left-handed.
Okay.
Now,
wow, it seems like more than that, because I seem like I have, you know, known many left-handed inclined people in my life, and it's got to be.
Well, it changed, like, it's specific, that's like in general. Now, there's these new mathematical models that say that the reason I say competitive nature is because if you're right-handed, it comes to a need to kind of balance cooperation, competition. So you're kind of thinking in the herd. You're not necessarily in the herd, but you're thinking, we're all going to go out and hunt this one thing. We need to work together.
Huh.
Left-handed people are kind of the oddball out. So you're kind of like pushing for yourself. You're like, no, me hunt for alone.
Sounds a little shaky, I gotta say. Well, it sounds a little...
They've actually gone through, and actually in the Animal Kingdom, you can have left pawed animals, you know, as the case may be.
I had two rat terriers, and I definitely noticed that one of them was more dominant when we played mm-hmm. with the ball, because he would reach up and like bat at it, and he'd always do it with his right paw.
Yeah. So, I mean, looking at it that way, there is the need to cooperation versus competition, and actually the model kind of etched out the percentages what they thought it would be.
Hmm.
And there's...
It seems like to me, it seems like to me, now I don't mean to cut you off, but I don't want to get too far from the, because the universe is not like you guys, so you get all competitive. You know what I think it is? I think you're bitter. I think it's because everything is designed for us right-handed people because we are the dominants, and, you know, mice, cars, like, you know, just like the controls on the steering wheel columns are often, I think, more inclined for right-handed people. And I think that kind of puts you guys on edge, and it kind of gives you a little extra spitfire. And I think that's what it is.
That is part of what they think, too.
Really?
Yeah, literally. It's like you're working against like the norm, so you have to be like a little bit more competitive against everything else because you have to have that edge.
All right, that makes sense.
Now, I mean, left-handed people's brains do actually... Naturally, left-handed, they do function differently. They handle processed language differently. The part of your brain that recognizes faces can sometimes be in a different part of the brain. So it's like how things are interconnected are actually different. You know, language centers. But, you know, you're saying you know a lot more left-handed people than you think that. Now, baseball, like of the top hitters in U.S. Major League Baseball, 58% are left-handed. You know, in general, baseball has 30%. Presidents, American presidents, out of the last five, two are left-handed, two are ambidextrous. And generally, you know, that was beginning to the fact that it wasn't so much in the idea that lefties had to be forced right-handed, but even the first two early presidents, I mean, starting in the 1980s, you know, you had to be. Even as a kid, it was sort of, they wanted you to be right-handed, but they weren't forcing you. But before that, I mean, at a certain time, left-handed was seen as a disability.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, there were definitely times where, you know, you were forced to be right-handed, you know, left-hand could be, you know, tied down. But I mean, since 1929, over a third of the presidents have been left-handed, you know, 14% ambidextrous. So this huge chunk of
that is, you know, so interesting.
You know, so it's these competitive, you know, politics. Now there's some idea that, you know, since communication is laid out differently, that may be a part of the, you know, that the fact that the top,
you know, seeing the president sign with his left hand looks kind of funky.
You know, it's funny because, like, being left-handed, I am specifically aware of when people are like writing with their left hand
because it's very odd looking. Actually, it does not look normal. So I could almost kind of see how an ignorant population might consider it, like a because it's just not, like, at first, it's just not what it looks like. Because the way the right-handed people write, they don't have to hold their hand quite out like that.
Well, it's all because in left-to-right writing societies, if you write left-handed, then your hand smudges over everything that you just wrote.
Yeah, right.
In elementary school, pick up my hand.
Yeah.
The whole side of my hand is covered in pencil.
Yeah.
Now, I'm rubbed against it.
I find myself able to do some tasks with my left hand. Like, I can do the camera switcher, I can do the soundboard, or I can do a mouse with my left hand. I'm very, you know, I would consider myself prominently a right-handed person. But I have trained myself over time to use my left hand for a lot of tasks, or, you know, a lot of other things, but primarily, like, stuff that, you know, is sort of generally you would attribute to your primary hand.
Yeah, well, I mean, some people are ambidextrous, and no matter what hand you is your dominant hand, you'll have various capabilities with the other hand. I mean, in any sport, I pitch hit in the middle of a game. I'll bowl right-handed, I'll bowl left-handed, drive everybody completely crazy. you know, I game predominantly with the right hand from my mouse.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But at work, I'm just as likely to just flip it over my monitor and use it on the left hand. Of course, still keeping with the right-handed triggers.
Nice.
So that I can hand it to somebody else and they're not completely messed up.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, these percentages of variant I mean, I knew that baseball had a use percent, a much larger percentage than the general population of these, because you always hear about, you know, the southpaws and pitch hitters and things like that. So it's sort of interesting, and it's kind of questionable as to how much this actually will pan out. I mean, yeah. There's mathematical models that say it so far, but you can do amazing things with math.
That's true. You can always make things go as you like, go as you want them to go. But yeah. It is an interesting statistic about the presidents. You got me there.
Mm-hmm.
You got me there. All right, Heather. Well, I believe it's time for the Two News Bite. Two Bite News.
Two Bite News Biting. Two Bite News.
So, you know, okay, so here's the joke to that is,
okay.
I named the clip on the soundboard Two Bite News, and that's what I look at when I fire it off. But I'm fully aware that the segment's called Two Bite News because it's right here in front of my face in the show notes. But I guess I just think I'm hilarious.
That's okay.
All right, so what is our first story in the Two Bite News?
Do not worry. Have no fear. Talking to yourself does not mean you're crazy. Science actually agrees.
Really? Now, do they? Okay, well, I'll let you tell. I have an interesting story. Go ahead and continue.
Okay, well, this is in general, you know. But there's studies that say that saying the name of an object out loud can actually help you find it quicker. They had, you know, people that, you know, here's a big room, find this. You know, they let some of the people just look around. And some people will be like, chair, 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 ah, chair. Or keys. Like, keys, keys, I'm trying to find my keys. Aha, there's keys.
I think I have just instinctively done that for, like, when I'm really looking for something, like my phone.
Well, adding that auditory component actually increases the visual centers in your brain. It helps, you know, it helps find those things quicker. Now, it doesn't necessarily attach to everything. So if something you're not familiar with, then it doesn't necessarily help you find it. Or if it's very abstract, mm-hmm. you know, you need a complete...
So lonely guys can't go around saying, girl, girl, girl.
Well, they can say girl, but I'm sure they have a strong connection, but they might end up at the computer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. Bad Heather.
Oh, Heather. You know what you get? You just earned yourself a... oh, you want? All right.
Yeah.
I knew you had it in you, though. I'm so proud. All right, so continuing on. Okay, I had a neighbor... who never stopped talking to himself. Do you think that's okay?
I don't know. I talk to myself a lot around the lab. I'll talk to the computer.
Is it loud? Like so say like you picture a man in his 50s okay. talking to another man in his 50s maybe 5 feet away from him. And uh-huh. just, you know, jokes and laughing and having yeah. a good time.
Except subtract the one person.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were in townhouses. So he was right next door.
Yeah. I talk more of a silent talk. Now it'll depend. Like if the machine's going and I have my little headphones on, you know, blocking out the sound and I don't notice that it's gone, I may continue talking the same range.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's generally sort of to backtrack into my brain. I'm like talking through a program or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there are definitely people who worked there that would just talk, like they're talking and then you'd walk away. And then you come back and they'd be like 5 minutes later in the conversation. And you're wondering whether they're just talking to themselves or they just didn't realize you weren't there.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. That kind of thing is a little odd.
You know, it just, everyone says, you know, you're crazy. Or if you argue with yourself, you're not still crazy either, I think.
Yeah.
Hey, no matter what, you're probably maybe going to win.
That's true. I have a lot of internal dialogues. You know, which I find useful for like thinking through a problem or something like that.
Yeah, my internal dialogues tend to be out because I'm a blabbermouth and I talk a lot.
Probably because you're left-handed.
That's probably what it is. I'm bitter to the world, so I must externalize my thought to make up for it.
Should we talk about liquid solar cells? That sounds pretty interesting. I think we've talked about them before, actually.
Yeah, we've talked about, there's lots of different types of solar cells that they're looking at. Some of the latest is they're developing, pathways to cheap, stable solar cells made from nanocrystals.
Nanocrystals!
So small, they can be in liquid ink. So you just, like, paint it or print it onto clear surface.
You could totally do, like, a DeskJet type thing, like an inkjet cartridge.
Yeah, just, like, total inkjet of that. About 4 nanometers in size, you could fit more than 250 billion on the head of a pin.
Wow.
So, you know, like you were saying, print it out on like a newspaper, possibly input it into various things. So it's kind of...
You know what I want to see it done is I want to see it printed out on roof tiles, you know, so you could just install it, put it on there, and bam, just plug them in.
Yeah, we've talked about other ones that were like that, you know, various, looking at all these different types of things that could possibly help, you know, increase the ability to get that solar power out of all the different ways you can.
Yeah.
So trying to think of out of the box way.
Solar is such an awesome way to go. If we can make, you know, maybe efficiency as we continue to make that work, maybe the solution in the meantime is just mass production of something that we can do on a large scale that we can spread out until we can make them more efficient, because that'd be really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is an interesting moment for the show, moving on, because, you know, like, actually, I think people will come to find out in a long time. Sometimes SciBite is a little bit ahead of the crowd, but now we have to give the major media out there, the rest of the news outlets, their crown, because they're finally catching up with SciBite. What's going on?
Yes, I've had a couple people write into me or talk to me about this. You know, some major media outlets said, you know, oh my gosh, we found a 9-planet system. It's the biggest we've ever had.
Yeah.
Until you go back to, you know, a couple weeks ago, SciBite 42.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that already, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. You know, first, you know, kind of thing, 130 light years away. There's new statistical analysis that says that the number of planets is up to 9, which, you know, cry Pluto lovers, but make it bigger than ours.
You titled it a busy planetary system, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. That was very nice. That really fit. And you really, you got it there. Plus, we talked about it. Is this the same type of stuff we talked about in previous shows as well? Or is this a different discovery? This is separate from...
Different discovery. Okay. Well, there were a couple of links in that particular story about previous exoplanets.
Yeah. That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, so I'll do kind of related stories sometimes, like, oh, remember we talked about this kind of a thing here or there?
Yep. Those are some great show notes because, yeah, it's nice to really tie it all together.
Yeah.
So, cool. Well, so there you go. So congratulations to the regular media. They're now... Yep. I guess they're keeping people informed. I don't really know what they're... Yeah. I don't know.
Well, there was another one that came out, too.
Oh, yeah?
Talking about a planet found in the habitable zone of a star.
Oh.
This one takes us all the way back to, I think we covered it in February.
Oh, really?
Early February, SciBite 32.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. And they're just now talking about it?
Well, a lot of these things, I think what it is...
They're evergreens.
You know, I have... Well,
They're evergreens. That's what I call them. Yeah. When I can record something that I can shelve. Yeah. And then roll out when I need content, like what I was supposed to do with this week's Foundry files, but I deleted them. But yeah, that kind of thing. So these might be stories they've been sitting on for a while. They've known about it, but they just haven't published.
Yeah, so they're like, either they're just holding on to them, or, you know, they've got a slot to fill, and they send out interns to crawl interwebs and go, ah, cool story.
Yeah. Right. Could be that, too. Hmm. Well, so that was February. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right, Heather. Well, are you ready to move on to the feedback?
I am.
All right, I'm opening up the SciBite mail computer here.
Okay.
All right. So this is an interesting one, and I saw this out there too, and I think you got some people writing into the show about this as well. The spirals on Mars.
Yes. Interesting photographs where it's literally looking like little nautilus spirals on Mars.
Yeah, almost like snail shells.
Yeah. Nautilus snail shells.
Yeah. Well, I can't. Okay. I think Nautilus the file manager. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It's okay.
All right.
It's okay. So this actually started researching in a totally different area. They were trying to look at nighttime infrared temperatures of these lava plates. And so it's like how then sort of Wikipedia style, someone said, oh, I wonder how the terrain between those plates look. And then some grad student starts noticing spiral patterns in the lava. You know, it took a little bit, you know, why it wasn't discovered till now. It took a little bit of zooming and tweaking of the contrast.
Oh, okay. I thought this was like new pictures.
No, it's old photographs. It's just that you had to be really zoomed in and tweak the contrast a little bit more to be able to kind of find these and find them to see them.
Very interesting.
Now, they are found on Earth as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these are the kind of things that are from lava.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can see them in the Hawaiian Islands, near the Galapagos Rift on the Pacific Ocean floor. So what happens is when you have lava flowing past, flows of lava going at different speeds or directions. Because sort of this rubbery crust can, you know, sort of peel or coil into wrinkles.
Right.
That can be twisted. So now you have a faster, you know, speed lane of lava kind of zooming by, and it sort of twists this up onto each other. So, right. You know, now these are, the ones on Mars are quite a bit bigger than seen on Earth. They can, on Mars, some of the pictures, you can see about almost 100 feet in diameter.
Mm.
About, in on the Earth, they're only about a third of that.
Okay.
So, just some interesting things. You know, we've seen these type of things on Earth, so we can kind of pretty much guess what's going on there. It's on a much bigger scale, but it's another one of those things where, it's in old data.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, it is. They found data in the data again.
Yeah, they did.
And also, it's one of those things, you know, I love, just like the Dust Devils. It's like mm-hmm. this weird kind of, somewhat, it's like a form of life on Mars. Like, Mars is continuing on in some kind of small way. That's, even though there's not, like, organic life, there's still activity.
Yeah. Well, this is older activity, but yes.
Well, yeah. No, but I'm sure something like that might happen again someday. Right? It's lava. That could come back, right?
Sure.
You don't think so?
Once things settle down, not so much. I mean, we get volcanoes and stuff.
You are ruining it. You are ruining it right
now. I know. Lava and volcanoes come from the Earth's plates moving around because they're still active, and Martian plants aren't really all that active.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a bummer. I was hoping maybe they were like party animals or something.
No, they partied and now they've settled down. They left college. No, they're settling into their nice little office job, and they're just doing their thing.
Oh, man, Heather, you humor me too much.
I thank you.
All right, well, why don't we do our spacecraft update? What's in the spacecraft update this week?
All right, again, the shuttle shuffle continues.
Shuttle shuffle.
Yep, on Friday, April 27th, the Spatial Enterprise was brought to New York City on the top of 747 aircraft. After the Discovery was delivered to the Smithsonian, you have got to check out a YouTube video in the show notes.
Wow.
It's like, you know, the plane's like, all right, I'm sorry, we're going to have to be delayed, scoot to this part of the tarmac.
And the guy's like, get over here, get a shot of this, get a shot of this.
Yeah. And it's like this person with a little camcorder in, or a phone cam, in their phone, in the plane, and looking out the window, and suddenly, here comes the shuttle down.
Wow.
On the 747, like on the runway next to them.
That is, I was like, so showing cool.
Some of the people at work, and I was like, you know, adding my own captions and voice track to it. They were all like, that would be the best delay ever.
Oh, yeah. I would love to see something like that, because it's one thing to see the pictures of it, but to see it in person.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. That would really be a treat.
But again, this week there are all sorts of image galleries and video galleries and stuff in the show notes. I'm sad that the shuttles are kind of being, you know, sent to their little retirement centers.
Yeah.
I'm excited that people get to be inspired by them, but I try not to talk about it too much. I'm just like, hey, check it out. They're moving about the country.
They're great, though. And we'll get to, you know, maybe now we'll get to go look at them on our own.
Yeah, there'll be one in California.
We got another update in here, don't we?
We do.
What is it? SpaceX?
SpaceX, the Falcon 9 rocket. It is preparing for a scheduled launch on May 7th.
Oh.
They're headed to the International Space Station. It will be the first private delivery to the space station.
Right.
Now, everything goes, I mean, they had a prep engine firing yesterday on Monday.
Ah.
Yesterday from this recording. So, you know, they're prepped, everything's looking on. So theoretically they'll go, they'll blast off, the capsule will decouple, it'll kind of make sure it's okay there. They're kind of putting it a pause in at every stage of the procedure. They'll go up, get stable, get close to the space station. Everyone will kind of look and be like, all right. And then they'll reach out with a little arm and pull it in. It'll deliver all sorts of supplies. And then the interesting bit is, we've done that before. But what's interesting about this specific program is that the space station will then dump stuff back into the capsule. And it will be able, it has heat shield, so it'll be able to survive. It'll land 200-300 miles off the west coast of California. So they'll actually be able to go out and retrieve it. So this kind of is the idea that, I mean, not only could they just, you know, the space station has trash, they can get rid of that trash, but they could also return
The crew that wants to come home or is on rotation to come home, that kind of thing?
Well, possibly. Even just tests. You know, they run these worms.
Experiments, yeah.
Yeah, return these experiments that need, you know, short term. So, you know, hey, we've got this data. Let's send it back and Earth can analyze it. And it's, you know, you don't have to wait for the next crew changeover or anything. You can just send these experiments back on and move things more quickly. So,
man, that's exciting. So, and it's going to happen the Monday before we record, because we do SciByte live on Tuesdays at 7:30 p.m. Pacific. This is happening Monday, May 7th, which is a Monday.
Yes, it is. And hopefully I will be full of glee and happy fun times and being like, yay, they launched. And then the next week I'll be like, hooray, they made a delivery.
Hopefully that's how the next couple of weeks of SciByte will go.
Yes.
It's hopefully not very much.
30 minutes or less, but it's getting there.
It's definitely not 30 minutes or less, but I guess you got to start somewhere.
Yes.
Now, a story that I actually have seen a lot of recently is in the headlines of meteorites.
Yes. It was a big California meteorite scene. They saw it, you know, flying over the skies, a huge area of, you know, even to Arizona, I believe, could see this huge fireball in the sky, sonic boom. And, you know, they've actually confirmed this thing was probably between 4 and 5 billion years old.
Mm.
Probably about the size of a minivan, a little over 154,000 pounds. Now it's, they found little pieces of it. It didn't burn up. It actually just causes the friction against the air actually just causes it to vaporize.
Ah.
But a couple of these small pieces actually made it to Earth. They've been, you know, so there's a handful of little pieces that people have found. There are some people that just like, they're almost professionals. They go out and look for these things.
Oh, that'd be kind of cool. So there's money in that, huh?
Yeah, you can totally sell it. So they have their little, you know, they eyeball everything. They're like, okay, here's where it's going to be predicted to land. I've got my metal detector. I've got my shovel.
Hmm.
And just go out and search away.
Well, and that's a good idea because, you know, it really is the hull of an alien spacecraft shot down by the U.S. military secret space operation force. So I would think that would go for a pretty penny. Space Wars, yeah. You know about it, right? The Space Wars? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, science is not convinced.
Science hurts. This is interesting because you have storm chasers, now you have meteorite chasers. That makes sense.
Yeah, the guy who found the first pieces has been doing this for more than 20 years. He's found meteorites on every continent except Antarctica. So, like I said, there's some people that really have a long-term history in this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So... Mm-hmm.
You gotta love something, Heather. And if it's space rocks, so be it.
Hey, I'm all for space rocks.
Yeah.
So, now there was a meteor shower that was going on during that time. They don't think, it's called the Lyrid meteor shower. They don't think it was part of that.
Huh.
But they are still looking for if anyone had photographic or video, even security camera footage, which is where a lot of these come from. If you have any of that kind of, there's places on the show notes to say, hey, you know, go input it here. And so they can kind of figure out exactly the trajectory of it, how it came in. So once they figure out that, they'll be able to kind of backtrack that and figure out where it came from. Was it part of the specific meteor shower? Was it just sort of a meteor asteroid that came flying through? And
right. Just a stray rock.
Yeah. Just a stray rock that Earth got in the way of.
Silly Earth. Hey, Heather, step over here into the time machine. Let's go back.
All right.
Here we go. All right. Oop, watch out. Oh, here we go, here we go. This one's rough. Oh, man. You know, I'm starting to get a feel for these. I can almost tell you how far it's going back just by the sway of the time machine. Our first destination this week is 75 years ago, May 6th, 1937. What happened, Heather?
Yes. Oh, the humanity. Not funny. The Hindenburg. At 7:25 p.m., the Hindenburg burned while landing.
Oh, yeah.
Lakehurst, New Jersey, I believe. So, you know, 61 crew members, 36 passengers. You know, everything seemed normal for them. And then suddenly,
that
huge burst of flame and rapidly blew through the 7 million cubic feet of hydrogen, which was filling the balloon. And it just went up so quickly.
And along with it, the whole industry of those types of aircraft.
Yeah. And it's actually funny because it's still debated to this day. Not the entire scientific community is convinced about any one reason why it happened.
You know, I have a fond spot for these types of vehicles because they look just like these. You know what it is? They look really fuel efficient. Like they look like they wouldn't take nearly as much to propel them because of their overall size. So, you know, you could use a lot less gas to make them go. And that seems like a good design to me. And plus, they just look awesome.
Yeah, I mean, there have been these type of dirigibles used for a long time. You know, if you have a big balloon, a couple of gangplanks in the middle, you can kind of turn it just by walking forward and back or left and right, you know, kind of aiming just by doing that.
75 years ago, really, if you think about it, is not that long ago.
No, it's kind of interesting sometimes when you think about these, you're like, whoa, that's where it is. And looking at some of the footage, you know,
we're showing that in the visually enhanced version right now, the footage of it. And it's just really astonishing how fast it all happens.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes you've seen like little clips of it, but to see like this much video, like, you know, chunks of video about it is kind of like, whoa, it kind of takes you back a bit.
Could you imagine if we lived in a world where these things were flying around the skies right now? That would be really something, wouldn't it?
As long as they weren't hydrogen filled. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. That would definitely be a requirement. Maybe they could fill them with something less blowy uppy.
Yeah, we could all talk like chipmunks and it could be helium filled.
I'd be up for that. Although you don't have to ride in the actual balloon, Heather.
Well, yeah.
All right. Our next destination takes us even farther back in time. 222 years ago, May 8th, 1790.
Acting on a motion by the bishop, they actually decided to go to the metric system. So the idea of starting the whole metric system kind of started. They started to say, we need a simple decimal placed system to measure units of distance and all these kind of things. So they started off with a meter was chosen as the length of a pendulum with a half period of a second. So like, all right, we're going to weigh out this pendulum. And when it hits this exact timing, that's going to be a meter. There, we chose it.
Really?
Yep. And so then they kind of changed it. It's also been, at one point, it was defined as 1/10 millionth of a distance between the North Pole and the equator. Then they changed it again to be adapted. There have been a couple of different ways to define it, but the whole process of a nice, clean, decimal-placed system that only the U.S. is very, we have our ways.
Yeah.
Except the scientific community, and then we have fun translating back and forth to six different ways.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's always that kind of extra language barrier there, but it's more precise, right?
It is.
So
it's more base 10 based. So it's
there you have it. All right. Well, the sci-fi computer here is blinking, and I do believe it's time to look up into the sky.
That's right.
What's going on this week up there?
Well, we recently had another coronal mass ejection, not hitting the Earth. It's going to pass by Curiosity rover. So it's had a couple hit over the last few months.
Oh, okay.
And it's equipped with to be able to handle that. It actually has some instrumentation on it to sense and study these solar storms. But this happens every once in a while.
That's kind of interesting. So it's, this, yeah, of course they figure that's going to happen. That makes sense.
Well, yeah, you have to prepare for that.
Yeah.
But looking forward this week into the sky, Thursday, May the 3rd, you're going to have Saturn and Spica to the lower of the moon.
Okay.
And Saturn's going to be farther away to the left. As we move on to Friday, now the moon's going to sit below of Saturn and Spica. On Saturday the 5th, now it'll be on the horizon below and to the left of them. So it's kind of moving as the nights go by. There's a picture in the show doc to kind of give you an idea of how they're going to be moving together as Friday, Saturday, move on.
Right.
Also on Saturday is going to be a full moon. Now, some people may hear in the news or have friends mention super moon. It's not scary.
The super moon, what's that?
It's So the moon has an orbit around the Earth.
Yeah.
You know, it has
I'm familiar with that.
And it has, you know, the closest part of its orbit and the farthest part. And at the closest part, at full moon, that means the moon is actually appears to be a little bit larger. It's about 14% larger, 30% brighter. So it's just when the one time of the year when the full moon is at the closest part of its orbit to the Earth.
Yeah, oh, it's beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful. All right. Well, yep. I can definitely look forward to that.
Yeah. That's on Saturday. So everyone check out the really bright moon on Saturday.
So the order of operation for Saturday, everybody, just so you know, is wake up, eat breakfast, watch Stoked Live at 11 a.m. Pacific.
There you go.
Go eat a big lunch dinner, and then in the evening, watch the moon.
Yep, the moon and Saturn and Spica.
Yeah.
All that crazy stuff. Note, be aware for anybody in the Americas, there's going to be an annular eclipse, which means, you know, like I said, the moon has distance. You know, it's not always the same distance from the Earth. So, you know, an eclipse, it's just the right size to block out the entire sun. Now, sometimes it doesn't. It has like a little ring of the sun or sung around
it. Oh, cool.
So for the Western Americas, you guys, you'll have one, an annular eclipse, and kind of a partial eclipse for the rest of the Americas. So once we get a little bit closer to that, I'll tune in.
You'll let everybody know?
Yeah. Yep, I will let everyone know.
I was actually just saying to somebody in the chat room that, well, often, you know, Heather waits till it's a little closer, that way people don't lose track of it. So I was actually just answering a question right then when you said that.
Oh, yeah, sometimes I'll mention things kind of far out, and then, you know, be like, hey, realize that this is coming this summer, and then as it gets a little closer, I'm like, hey,
it's coming up. Yeah,
it's coming up.
Yeah, there's always a few things like that. That's what's so cool.
Yep.
That's why I love that segment.
Yep. For our friends in the Southern Hemisphere, all these things are pretty much the same. It's just you have to vertically flip all things. So when I said Saturn and Spica will be, you know, below the moon, then you just flip it. It'll be above the moon.
Okay. Well, there you go. Just flip it and reverse it, folks.
Just flip.
Like,
vertically flip.
I know, but Taylor, that's not from a song. Well, okay. I think that's the whole show right there, isn't it?
I think so.
Well, awesome. Well, great show, Heather.
Great show, Chris.
All right, everyone. Well, thanks for tuning to this week's episode of SciByte. Now, SciByte is live, like I mentioned, on Tuesday evenings over at jblive.tv at 7:30 p.m. Pacific. And then, of course, we release just a few hours after that with all the links to everything we talked about in the show notes. All right, everyone. Well, thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of SciByte. We'll see you next week.